Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with As It Is. We come to you 7 days a week with ways to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we will talk about religion in the United States. There are some important changes happening among people who hold traditional ideas about Christianity. Then we will hear about children in the Central African Republic who are seeking safety by joining militias. Let's get started with part one. More than 30 American states now recognize marriages between two people of the same sex. An increasing number of mainline Christian groups are also accepting same-sex unions. But most evangelical Christians say the Bible condemns sexual relations among people of the same sex. They note writings found in the Bible's Book of Leviticus and the Book of Romans. Evangelicals firmly believe that Christianity's holy book is free from mistake. Now, a well-known student of evangelicalism is saying that the traditional reading of the Bible is wrong. Jonathan Evans has more.
The religious service looked like one at any evangelical church, except that same-sex couples were sitting in pews. A man rested his head on the shoulder of another man, and a woman had her arm around her female partner. They were among the several hundred people who recently gathered at the National City Christian Church in Washington, D.C. The attendees were a mix of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Christians. They were there for a meeting of the Reformation Project. The idea for the project came from a new way of thinking about the Bible. Matthew Vines formed the group after a testimonial he posted 2 years ago on YouTube became popular. The young man spoke in the video about being Christian and gay. Matthew Vines said that he did not choose to have an interest in men.
I am gay. I didn't choose to be gay.
He said the aim of the project is to show that there is a path to affirming the full authority of the Bible and affirming same-sex relationships. In the Christian Bible, Jesus' follower Paul condemns sexual acts between men. But Mr. Vines says loving gay relationships were nearly all unknown 2,000 years ago.
The heart of Scripture's teaching is that marriage is about commitment, that it's about keeping one's covenant with one's spouse in the same way that God keeps his covenant with us. And that's something that same-sex couples can do just as well as opposite-sex couples can.
He argues that a teaching that has failed and causes much suffering cannot be correct. But critics say he is just reading the Bible his own way to show that being gay is acceptable. One such critic is British evangelical clergyman Sam Albury.
What you have to do to the Bible to make it approve of same-sex relationships is profoundly unevangelical.
Evangelical Christians accept many biblical scriptures literally. In other words, they believe most words of the Bible represent exact, precise truth. David Gushy is an evangelical ethicist, someone who studies what is morally right and wrong. He noted that the Bible has 31,273 verses.
The number of verses that can be called on you support the traditional position. It's essentially, well, it's six passages, maybe 15 verses at the most.
David Gushee teaches at Mercer University, a Baptist religious school in Atlanta, Georgia. He recently published a book called Changing Our Mind. It caused a lot of discussion among evangelical Christians. He said his change of heart came partly from meeting gay people and from learning that his sister had declared herself to be a lesbian. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The Central African Republic has been unsettled since 2013. First, the Salika rebel group ousted the government. The Salika fighters were mostly Muslim. Christian militias answered with rebel attacks. Thousands of people have been killed in the fighting. Millions have been forced from their homes. Among the victims are children whose parents died or have gone missing. For these boys and girls, joining an armed group is one of the only ways to find protection. Kelly Jean Kelly tells us about them.
A boy named Jerome said he joined a militia when an opposing group attacked his village. Some people were burned in their homes. Others were shot when they sought to run away.
I'll never forget that day, he says. The Salika killed my uncle. That pushed me to join the anti-Balaka militia.
The anti-Balaka is a coalition of armed groups opposed to the Salika rebels. Another boy, Serge, joined the anti-Balaka just before it attacked the capital in December
2013.
He says,
I was a good fighter, fearless. The commander liked me.
Serge says he is 17 years old, but he has a boy's face and a thin body. He looks much younger. Most children in the armed groups are teenagers. Some are younger than 10. Serge says children's ages and sizes help to determine their positions in the armed groups. Strong boys, such as Serge, might become fighters. Younger children clean up. Judith Levaye is a deputy representative of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. She said, the number of children who are part of armed groups has risen over the past few months. She says that up to 10,000 children have ties to the armed groups. Some have been part of the militias for 2 years.
In some cases, they've gone so far in the level of atrocities that it's very difficult for them to return to where they're from. And if we don't accelerate and respond to the needs, there's a risk that there's going to be a lost generation in this country.
UNICEF has negotiated with the groups to release about 1,400 of the children, including Jerome and Serge. One-fifth of the children being released are girls. Ms. Levaye says they were used as cooks, cleaners, or were given to commanders to marry.
They do all the chores, the camp chores, but they also act as sex slaves. Or they get under the protection of one of the commanders. And then sometimes they get pregnant. Some are really, really young, like 10, 12, 14 years old. So for them, once they are identified to be released from the armed group, we need to really pay attention to their needs and to make sure to provide them with support so that they can earn a living or go back to school and care for their child.
Ms. Levaye says the children need a chance to rejoin their families. But for some, like Jerome, returning to his mother and father is not possible. Serge is not in contact with his family either, and he does not know what is happening in his hometown. He said, When he was with the anti-Balaka group, he wore a rebel uniform that made people respect him. He felt like a man. If the battle continues, he said, and the rebel group needs him, he will join the anti-Balaka again. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. A student from overseas did well on a research paper for an American college. She said, "Research takes up space, and the words in the research are correct because the writing is in English." Now, however, she has to write a narrative essay in her own words. She is afraid she does not know enough English. Such a paper can be hard for anyone. Experts at Purdue University in Indiana define a narrative essay as often anecdotal, experiential, and personal. In other words, this kind of essay usually tells a story from the writer's experience. It is about something the writer has lived. A narrative essay usually provides an insight. For example, such essays might be named "How I Won the 100 Meter Dash" or "How I Came to Study in the United States." It is often written in the first person, the I form, and it offers a chance for creative writing, for expressing yourself about yourself in the paper. The Purdue experts say that if your narrative essay is written as a story, you need to provide an introduction, a plot, a setting, a climax, and a conclusion or ending. Often, the narrative essay requires characters as well, and this essay usually follows events in the order they happened. Judith Baumel is a poet and professor at Adelphi University in New York.
Sometimes I have an exercise where I ask students to remember an early moment with their parents and sort of think about where they were physically, think about what was in front of them, what was behind them, what was above them, below them. Just describe it out.
Professor Baumel describes the exercise as remarkable. She says she learned it from another writer, graphic novelist Linda Berry. Ms. Baumel also has advice for English students who worry about not using the right words. She says the language has a great vocabulary.
And that's a real bonus for students who are just learning English. You really can play around with the vocabulary pretty early.
She says she introduces language learners to the thesaurus, which she calls a great resource. A thesaurus is a kind of dictionary. It can help you replace a word with a synonym, another word having the same or similar meaning. Sometimes it also provides antonyms, words with opposite or nearly opposite meanings from the word you are replacing. Judith Baumel notes the example of words that all describe a place to sit. Words like chair and sofa and couch and chaise.
All of this, that's available online now. Anybody in the world can just go online and get an electronic thesaurus.
And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 2 years of a bitter, bloody civil war started to show their effects on both the Confederate States of the South and the Union States of the North. Both sides began to feel the pressure of the costly struggle. The South, however, felt the pressure more severely because it was weaker in troop strength and industrial strength. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles discuss the early summer of 1863 in the American Civil War.
In 1863, the Confederate States were becoming short of supplies. Food and guns were difficult to find to keep the Confederate armies in the field. Men were also needed. More and more men. There seemed to be no end to the demand for men to fill the places left empty by dead and wounded soldiers. Many in the South were heavy of heart, and hope among them slowly started to sink. The war was tiring. Its suffering was more than they could bear, and the situation in the West made matters worse. Union armies were on the move in the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. Their successes were becoming a serious threat. They might soon win control of the whole Mississippi River. This would split the states of the Confederacy and might end its very existence. Something was needed to raise up the spirits of the South, to break the pressure of Union armies.
General Robert E. Lee believed that he had the answer, an invasion of the North. This, he felt, would throw fear into the people of the North and weaken the Union war effort. Lee had organized an army of 75,000 men at Fredericksburg, Virginia, halfway between Washington and Richmond. Lee began moving his men June 3rd. They marched northwest into the Shenandoah Valley. The valley led north to the Potomac River. Across the river was the narrow neck of western Maryland, then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the target. Its rich farmland produced plenty of food, enough to feed Lee's hungry army for the summer.
Standing in the way of Lee's army was a small Union force at Winchester in northern Virginia. There were only 7,000 Union soldiers, and they had no idea that the Confederate army was nearby. The Confederates easily defeated them. More than half of the Union troops were captured. The others fled. Now, there was nothing to stop Lee from marching into Pennsylvania. The huge Army of the Potomac was behind him, near Washington. The Union commander, General Hooker, had to keep the army between Lee and Washington to prevent the Confederates from seizing the national capital.
Lee's army crossed western Maryland and entered Pennsylvania. His soldiers found the Pennsylvania countryside very different from Virginia's. Virginia had been a battleground for 2 years, and the land showed it. Many of its farms had been destroyed. Its stores were empty. Pennsylvania had not been touched by the war. Its big farms were rich. Its towns and villages were full of food and goods of all kinds. The hungry, poorly clothed soldiers could not believe their eyes. This was the land of the enemy, they cried, and they could take whatever they wished. But General Lee said no. He said supplies could be taken only by Confederate supply officers. And, he said, they must pay in Confederate money for everything they took.
Lee did not want to anger these people in Pennsylvania. Many of them did not support the Union war effort. Some of the rich farmers said openly that they did not care who won the war. They said they only wanted to be left alone. Lee was sure that many in the North felt the same way. There had been signs that people were growing tired of the war. Coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania had shown their feelings toward the war a few months earlier. They rose up against a new law drafting men into the Union Army. The miners did not want to fight. They refused to join the army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to the mining areas to put down the riots.
Farmers in nearby Ohio also rebelled against the draft law. They refused to be drafted. Instead, they took guns and battled soldiers who came to arrest them. Feelings against the war were growing stronger, not only in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but also in several other farm states of the North. These areas saw a growing support for a peace party, a political party opposed to the war. Leaders of this movement were Democrats called Copperheads. They got this name because they wore on their coats a copper penny with the head of an Indian.
The chief Copperhead was a former Ohio congressman. His name was Clement Vallandigham. As a member of Congress, Vallandigham criticized the war and the Republicans. He told them, "The war for the Union is, in your hands, a most bloody and costly failure. War for the Union was abandoned, and war for the Negro was openly begun with stronger effort than before." "With what success?" Vallandigham asked. "Let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer." Vallandigham said he wanted peace, and he wanted it immediately. He offered a simple program. Stop the fighting, make a ceasefire, and let some friendly foreign nation negotiate peace between North and South.
After he lost his seat in Congress, Vallandigham opened a campaign to become governor of Ohio. He traveled all across the state, speaking out against the war. He said Republicans did not want peace. He said they wanted to fight until every black man was free. The Union military commander for Ohio was General Ambrose Burnside, a former commander of the Army of the Potomac. After losing the Battle of Fredericksburg, Lincoln removed Burnside as army commander and sent him to Ohio. Burnside was worried. Too many people in Ohio opposed the war. He believed that much of what was being said and done in Ohio was close to the crime of treason. Burnside announced several new measures to quiet the opponents of the war. One of these orders limited the right of citizens to criticize government military policy. Another declared that statements of support for the enemy would be punished as treason. Vallandigham refused to recognize Burnside's right to give such orders to civilians. On May 1st, he made a campaign speech to a big crowd at Mount Vernon, Ohio. He denounced Burnside's orders and spoke of the president as King Lincoln. Vallandigham claimed that Lincoln was using the war to become a dictator. He said Lincoln did not want peace, that the president had rejected peace offers from the South. Once again, he said the war was not a struggle for the Union, but a fight to free the slaves of the South. And he said, "Men of Ohio, who let themselves be drafted into the Union Army, were no better than slaves themselves." Burnside had sent several army officers to listen to the speech. When they reported what Vallandigham said, Burnside ordered his arrest. Without question, the man had violated the general's orders. Late the next night, soldiers went to Vallandigham's home in Dayton. They knocked on the door and said they had come to arrest him. Vallandigham called for help and refused to let the soldiers enter. They broke down the door, seized him, and took him to a military prison in Cincinnati. A few days later, Vallandigham went on trial before a military court in Cincinnati. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.